The next case on the Southern Panels docket is Abrams versus Sanson and Schneider, cases 73838 and 75834. Justice Silver is not on this case, and it is we have the benefit of the Chief Justice today to join this panel, and he'll participate in its resolution. Chief Justice Givens has a disclosure, however, before we begin.
Yes, thank you, Justice Hardesty. Again, I was recently assigned to this case. Justice Silver recused, so I prepared for it very recently for today, and I wanted to disclose to the parties that several years ago the Supreme Court authorized a committee to be formed to revise the financial disclosure forms in family court statewide, which we did, and I asked Ms. Abrams to be on that committee. I worked with her closely on that committee over a couple of years to get those forms done. I want to make the respondents aware of that. I feel I can be fair and impartial on the case, but I wanted to make that disclosure. Normally, I would have made it in writing, but I came into this late, so I didn't have an opportunity to do so.
I understand. I have concerns.
Okay, thank you.
Myself.
Thank you, Mr. Houston.
Mr. Willick, do you need time to confer with your client before you decide that issue? Okay, well, you're welcome to do so, as you know.
No problem.
Okay. And Ms. Abrams, same question to you. Okay. All right, then, if counsel are ready to proceed, Mr. Willick.
And I will reserve 5 minutes.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, Marshall Willick for Jennifer Abrams, may it please the court. There are three primary reasons to reverse as to Sanson. One, extortion is not protected speech. Two, the assertions here were knowingly false, and to the degree they're defended as opinions, they were based on facts that were knowingly false. Three, under the Shapiro factors, the comments concerned a private controversy, not a matter of public concern. The Schneider slap judgment shouldn't even exist because no communication by Schneider was part of the defamation claims. First, as to extortion, the California courts have long held that communications used to further a pattern of extortion cannot be good faith communications. They are not statutorily protected under anti-SLAPP. See, for example, Flatley versus Morrow, 39 Cal 4th 299 from 2006. Sanson, who openly advertises that he does dirty work so you can remain anonymous, carried out Schneider's threatened extortion with the attack article, followed by Schneider saying, withdraw your motion, and all of this, meaning the smear campaign, goes away. As explained in the declaration of Brandon Levitt, it is unrefuted in the record that Schneider threatened to take action out of court, gave Sanson the video of the closed hearing to use in the smear campaign, and gave him money. Judge Duckworth's recusal order found, as a matter of fact, that Sanson's efforts are to manipulate, intimidate, and control. In other words, he is in the business of extortion and attempted judicial corruption. That is what he does for a living. That is why this case is in the senior judge program. His attempts to make ex parte contact with judges were so relentless that every single elected judge in the entire 8th Judicial District has either recused or been disqualified. When Abrams refused to withdraw the sanctions motion, the extortion continued with the Bully article, the Loft Rounds article, and others. And when that didn't get Ms. Abrams to withdraw her motion, Sanson started attacking her SO, her significant other, me. As this court recently held in Collin, timing is a pretty good indication of circumstantial evidence of knowing falsity. And it certainly is here. Sanson argues there was only 4 or 5 communications, but it was actually hundreds of messages broadcast repeatedly, multiple times a day, to tens of thousands of people for months, all intended to do cumulative damage. That is not reporting of any kind. That is character assassination for a purpose, in this case, extortion for hire. The fact that illicit conduct is conducted by words rather than knives does not make it any more deserving of legal protection, as this court held recently in Coker. This court should hold as the California courts have held, that when communications are part of a conspiracy to extort, they definitionally are not in good faith and cannot be protected under the First Amendment, either as truthful or mostly truthful or opinions by being cloaked in ambiguous language. Context matters, or as it's sometimes put, in determining whether communications are made in good faith, the court must consider the gist or sting of the communications as a whole, rather than parsing individual words or...
Excuse me.
Presente.
Thank you.
Or I lost the last part of the words. I believe that opinion came out today. The second reason for reversal is that the assertion at issue here was of known false facts, and to the degree there were opinions based on false facts. As this court succinctly stated in Hofter, false statements of fact are not entitled to First Amendment protection of any kind. The attack article says there was a finding of undue influence. There was no such finding. In fact, the judge specifically said she wasn't making such a finding. It was just Schneider's opinion. The defendants knew the accusation was false when they made it. They had the video. Dealing with the false statement that Abrams' client lied about his finances, Judge Elliott stated on the record at least three times that she was mistaken about that and retracted it at least three times. She then sent Sampson an email personally telling him that her original belief was wrong. Yet Sampson ignored that and claims that his opinion, based on facts he knows to be false, is that Abrams is unethical, broke the law, should be sanctioned, and should be referred to the state bar for discipline. Now, on that last point, the case law says that doing that, making an accusation of unethical acts requiring referral to the bar, that's a quote, are assertions of fact, not of opinion. That's the held case in our footnote 197. Judge Elliott's original misinformation were the false facts the defendants fed to her off the record, which she specifically declared false once they were examined in open court. No authority allows a defendant to invent their own false facts. That case law doesn't exist. In fact, the burden is on the defendants under prong one to prove truth. It's their burden. The affidavit submitted with the defendant's motion filing didn't even claim that they believed their assertions to be true. And they certainly didn't prove it in the case below.
Mr. Wilk, I'll interrupt you 1 second on that. Just kind of an update for all of you. The Supreme Court filed an opinion today at noon in a case called Rosen versus Tarkanian, authored by Chief Justice Hardesty, and discussing his standards on anti-SLAPP motions and all like that. I'm sure none of you know this, you know, like this as it just happened, but I just want to refer you to that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The most recent pronouncement.
I did try to review it a couple minutes ago. That's actually what I was quoting from a moment ago, saying that context matters. You don't pick words in isolation. You don't parse them in isolation. You can't pick apart, which is what Judge Leavitt did. An individual word here, an individual word there, and say, I can come up with a non-defamatory meaning to this word. What you do is you look at the entirety of a communication, and if you read the treatise, SAP, it says that you look at the headlines, you look at the bolding, you look at the emphasis, you look at the timing. You take the entire penumbra of how a communication comes out, and you take it as a whole in trying to determine defamatory content. So if it screams in the headlines, X murdered Y, and then says, well, maybe it was a parking ticket. The headline matters, and the emphasis matters, and the intention matters. The attack article, saying the opposite of what you know to be true doesn't make it substantially true. It makes it a lie. The attack article falsely represented that the hearing was about Abrams' conduct. It wasn't. Sampson's headlines say the opposite of what was actually found, which is why the opinion from today is relevant, and the SAP treatise is relevant. That continued in the bully article. The judge actually drafted the order in question sua sponte after the lawyers stipulated that it could be drafted. Saying she was bullied into entering a stipulated order is the opposite of the truth.
Mr. Wilk, of course, the other side's arguing these are statements of public interest involving the family court and all that. Do you feel this is, what's your position on that?
It is, and if you take a look at the Shapiro factors, and I was really getting to whether or not these were truthful or not, and they're not. But if you get to the Shapiro factors as to whether or not they're public, this is an amorphic public interest. Exactly what this court said is not at issue in looking at specific defamatory content. The four-part test confirms that while people might be curious about what happens, well, about 4 weeks ago, the California Supreme Court issued an opinion in Wilson versus Cable News. There's no legitimate public interest in a garden variety dispute like the Sater's divorce. That's because, absent unusual circumstances, a garden variety dispute concerning a non-public figure will implicate no public issue, including if someone makes an accusation in the middle of that case of workplace misconduct. As that court held, citing lots of examples, those charged with defamation can't, by their own conduct, create a defense by trying to make the claimant a public figure. It is the specifics of the allegation, not the amorphous interest. That's relevant. In Shapiro, this court said the same thing. While readers might be curious what happens in a garden variety divorce, that's not a matter of public interest. The sanctions motion by Abrams against Schneider was a private dispute within a private dispute. The only people that cared about it were the parties to the action. And it was in a closed hearing, in a sealed case. Whether Abrams said, excuse me, I'm in the middle of a sentence, is not of interest to a substantial number of people. Whether a judge said incorrect statements at the beginning of a hearing and then said, oh, I'm sorry, I was wrong on the facts, and corrected them, is not of interest to anybody in the world except the parties to that case. That is a very small audience of legitimate interest as to whether that has any public concern. Nobody else cares if a judge said one thing and then said, oh, I got it wrong, and fixed it. There was no closeness between the statements and any legitimate public interest. The fact that taxpayers fund the courts is exactly the type of broad and amorphous social interest that this court said in Shapiro doesn't constitute a matter of public interest for purposes of defamation. Location does not make private matters in a divorce case public interest. Shapiro was a guardianship case.
Mr. Willick,
I'm sorry.
Would you distinguish between, you keep referencing making a private divorce public interest. These statements don't seem to be about the divorce at all. They seem to be about the conduct of the judge and the conduct of the attorney. So how things are happening in the family court in that context. It just happened to be the divorce that was occurring at the time. I don't view these statements as being about the Saters. I view them as being about either Ms. Abrams or about the court. Is that a wrong distinction?
No, it's not a wrong distinction. It is the context in which the behaviors are in question occurred. I saw that I just hit the 5 minutes. Can I answer your question?
That's your time. You have,
okay, yeah. Well, I don't want to not answer your question.
Sure.
But the point is that the actions of a private attorney in a private divorce case are not of interest to a substantial number of people. And they can't be made a matter of a substantial interest to a substantial number of people by being broadcast to lots of people. That's what this court said in Shapiro. It's private actions in a private case. I mean, whether an attorney, let's suppose somebody was rude. If you go to family court on any day of the week, you will see an awful lot of rude comments. You will see a lot of judges that get things wrong and they get them right. You will see a lot of people saying, excuse me, I was talking, or don't interrupt me, or please sit down. That happens literally every day in every courtroom in every case. These are not matters of public interest to anybody except the people in the room. The rest of the world doesn't legitimately care. And these are private disputes. So the fact that an individual was targeted, and that is the proper word here, targeted for character assassination for a period of months for the purpose of extorting the removal of a sanctions motion, makes the conduct illicit. You can't extort economic favors out of court without corrupting the court process, which is why the Judge Duckworth order is relevant. Because that's what he said the business model is. That's what they do. And it can't be allowed to happen. Because if it does, where do you stop? Take off your motion or I'll break your leg. Take off your motion or I'll burn your office down. Take off your office. Take off your motion or I'll ruin your reputation. These are the same thing. They can't be allowed out of court. So no, the fact that it happens to be an attorney, this is the one case that is most addressed, Rivera, from our footnote 150, statements about somebody like Ms. Abrams, who has received little or no public attention or media coverage, do not concern a matter of public interest. They just don't. They are private. Barnes GLB says pretty much the same thing. These are matters of people that are doing their jobs. That does not make them matters of public interest. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I may.
Okay.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Maggie McCletchie for Steve Sansa from Veterans and Politics International. While the Abram parties have tried to frame the speech at issue in this case as one involving a private dispute. This case is, in fact, about protecting people from speaking out about their concerns about the operation of family court. VIPI and Steve Sanson serve as public watchdogs, including of the judiciary. They comment on the conduct of attorneys in the public courtrooms and the conduct of publicly elected taxpayer-paid judges. A major purpose of the First Amendment is protecting exactly this kind of free discussion concerning government affairs. This court's rules and cases, the First Amendment, the common law, and the policy underpinning the fair report privilege all underline the fundamental issue in this case that the Abram parties would have this court ignore, and that's that the administration of justice is the people's business. Family court is no exception to that rule about courts. In fact, family court is probably especially a matter of public interest, and that's because it affects so many people. While it's true, we concede that specific details of some specific family law cases may be private, that does not cloak the family court system in secrecy. And any right to privacy in those cases doesn't belong to Ms. Abrams or Mr. Willick. It belongs to those litigants. Family law attorneys are simply not protected from criticism regarding their conduct in court or their professional conduct more broadly. In fact, there's California cases that don't even deal with in-public courtroom behavior, the Abbo case and the Choice case, that talk about the fact that an attorney's conduct is a matter of public interest, for example, allegations of embezzlement. Here, we have more than just an attorney's professional conduct. We also have attorney's professional conduct in the courtroom, and that is the focus of the communications at issue. Another important point is that you don't have to be a lawyer, get an expert, or provide legal citations to express your opinions regarding attorneys in court. Mr. Willick said people routinely talk rudely in family court or talk about what happened in court that day. You don't have to be a lawyer to talk about family court. Mr. Sanson and Veterans in Politics are welcome to go to family court and do court observing. There are also not black and white answers to questions such as whether an attorney is zealous or overzealous or seals too many documents. If you look, read the transcript, and I believe it's currently under seal, but the transcript from the Sater hearing, I do think if it weren't a matter of opinion, whether or not Ms. Sanson is a bully or overzealous, I think there'd be a good faith basis for saying that she is, in fact, a bully and rude in that court proceeding. She cuts off the judge. Judge Elliott said during that proceeding, and there's no contest that the article, the attack article, portion restating from that transcript is correct. Judge Elliott said, I'm the judge, and in a moment I'm going to ask you to leave. She felt Ms. Abrams was being rude. She did at the end correct herself regarding what she found about Mr. Sater, but she did not change her opinion about what she commented to be a pattern with Ms. Abrams' firm. And again, the focus of these articles is not the Saters or any private matter. It's Ms. Abrams, and it's about the inability of the judge to control her courtroom in Mr. Sanson's point of view.
In conjunction with the articles, he posted the entire hearing, correct?
Correct.
Not just cherry-picked pieces. He put the whole hearing up there. Is that correct?
He put the entire hearing up there, and he asked questions. The judge did say on the record that she found a pattern of unethical conduct by Ms. Abrams and her firm. And at the end of that article, he does query, well, shouldn't this be reported to the state bar? If there is unethical conduct, should it be reported to the state bar? Non-attorneys have every free speech right to disagree with judges and attorneys about what should and shouldn't be sealed and what is and isn't appropriate behavior in court. In fact, I think that the kitchen sink lawsuit that the Abram parties filed is exactly what the anti-SLAPP statute was designed to protect against. To distract from the central anti-SLAPP analysis and the First Amendment analysis, the Abram parties try to focus on things that are not properly before the court and aren't relevant to the determination. Judge Duckworth's opinion after this case and his opinion regarding Steve Sanson's conduct in another matter is not relevant to whether the speech at issue in this case is protected. I don't know that this court has addressed it, but California courts have held over and over that motive is irrelevant when you're looking at anti-SLAPP analysis. Now, it's a statement of fact. Obviously, whether it's false and you knowingly publish the statement anyway, that's an issue. But your motive for speaking doesn't matter. That brings me to another thing. They say over and over that there's extortion, that there's conspiracy. At some point, they filed, they had a claim, a RICO claim, in their complaint. When they had hired Bailey Kennedy, they admitted there was no basis to that. But there has been no admission of any illegal conduct. There's no evidence of illegal conduct. And by the way, Mr. Schneider is a proper defendant for the anti-SLAPP case because Mr. Schneider, they argue that he's responsible for the statements at issue in the case as well. But all these peripheral issues about whether or not it was Mr. Schneider that gave the video to Mr. Sanson and whether they conspired to dare to report on Ms. Abrams' conduct in our courtrooms are absolutely irrelevant. And that is because you can, in fact, conspire to engage in free speech. And that's what this case is about.
Ms. McClutchie, I want to talk about the Schoen statements because those are different. It's clear these are all published. And my question with the Schoen statements, are those published to third parties within the meaning of the law and within the umbrella that we're talking about?
Well, I believe that what they argued is that those Schoen statements, this lawsuit was brought by Ms. Abrams and her law firm, mm-hmm. and he's part of that law firm. And some of the statements concern him, and he's not a plaintiff in this case. And more importantly, you can't be defamed to yourself. It requires a statement to somebody else. But the statements that he made, that Steve Sanson allegedly made to Mr. Schoen and are set forth in his declaration, things like, she's on my priority list. A reporter or a watchdog group can focus on a particular person or a particular act or event to give attention to. He's concerned. Mr. Sanson was concerned about her in courtroom conduct. So was Judge Elliott. So for him to, if he said things like, she's on my priority list, or if he says things on his website, I'm not afraid to get dirty, that he's not afraid to take on difficult issues, that does not change the analysis in this case.
And Mr. Schoen contacted Mr. Sanson, correct? He instigated the call.
Yes, he did. He did.
Okay.
And I think part of what's going on with their arguments and their efforts to distract is that this is not, they ask you in their briefs to say, hey, they literally ask you to find that they're the good guys and that my client is the bad guy. But, first of all, every litigant thinks that he's the good guy, and every person representing thinks their client is the good guy. But this case is not about a popularity contest. I realize that these are very well-respected family law attorneys. This is not about a popularity contest. It's about whether people have a free speech right to talk about family court and whether that right is protected by the First Amendment and the anti-SLAPP statute. On this, I'll point out that a speaker doesn't need to be uncontroversial to be protected by the First Amendment. In fact, unpopular speech needs the most protection, not the least. Steve Sanson's style is not at issue before the court today. In a case involving the Westboro Baptist Church, the United States Supreme Court noted that the First Amendment reflects a profound national commitment to the principle that debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court found three things. One, that the speech, even the very hateful speech at issue in that case, was a matter of public concern. That analysis, this case in Croker, has said that perhaps while backyard disputes or false statements regarding art may not be protected, public interest is supposed to be interpreted broadly. Here we have core political speech about our judicial system. In that case, the Supreme Court found that the speech at issue was speech on an issue of public concern, despite the fact that it was very disgusting and hateful speech. The court also found that it was necessary to protect even that type of vitriolic speech in order to ensure that we don't stifle public debate. Third, it found that because that speech wasn't on a matter of public concern, that the Westboro Baptist Church couldn't be sued in tort because doing so would violate the First Amendment. I just want to say a few things about the first prong of the analysis. They've said that we have it at some point in this litigation, they've said, well, you never said good faith in your declaration. There is no separate good faith declaration. The anti-SLAPP statute itself defines what a good faith communication is. And one of the elements is not actually good faith, because again, motive and a court's personal subjective views about the speaker or the speaker's speech is not relevant. The only elements are that they have to be made in direct connection with an issue of public interest. This clearly is. Second, it has to be in a place open to the public or in a public forum. And sending something out by email in addition to posting it on the internet cannot take it out of the protection of either the First Amendment or the anti-SLAPP statute. Otherwise, the New York Times could be sued for having email subscribers, and as well as having a printed newspaper. Third, the speech has to be truthful or is made without knowledge of its falsehood. They argue that Mr. Sanson had to establish that these statements were true. These were statements of opinion, and they to try to argue the opinion isn't covered by the anti-SLAPP statute completely undermines its First Amendment underpinnings, and the First Amendment is relevant to both prongs of the anti-SLAPP analysis. It's irrelevant that it is opinion in terms of, you don't need to say that something is truthful or made without knowing a falsehood when it's a matter of opinion.
Ms. McCloskey, can I ask you about one other issue in the interest of time here? It's maybe more of the minor issues in the case, but the appellants are saying that the court was wrong in not allowing them to do discovery. And we, you probably saw an opinion we filed a week ago where we agreed with the district court that when he did allow discovery. So sure. What's your thoughts about that?
I represented amicus in that case, Your Honor.
Yeah.
So in that case, and I haven't had time to file a notice of supplemental authority, but this court made something very clear, and that's that a district court's decision, including in the anti-SLAPP context, is subject to an abuse of discretion standard. The other thing I want to point out on discovery is that it's only permissible by statute on the second prong of the anti-SLAPP analysis, not the first prong. And they have to make, under the statute, they have to make a specific showing that discovery is needed and is appropriate. With regard to their burden, they never came forward with any prima facie evidence. Self-serving statements such as "I am damaged" don't suffice. The anti-SLAPP order has to be upheld because they conceded that the RICO claim, the conspiracy claim, the harassment claim, and the injunctive relief claim were all invalid. They conceded that an argument, but they're included in the anti-SLAPP order. They're dismissed by the district court's order. So that at least that portion of the district court's order is necessarily upheld. But all of the claims fail. While obviously we all know that the burden is far lower than it used to be in the anti-SLAPP statute, but you still need basic legal and factual sufficiency, and none of their claims meet that basic requirement. For example, they didn't plead special damages. Frankly, the kitchen sink nature of their complaint, the fact that they conceded that four of these claims when they did have separate counsel, I think reflects that this is exactly the kind of lawsuit that the anti-SLAPP statute was designed to protect against. It was designed to stop people from filing lawsuits, to use finances, to leverage people into default and into silence. And that's exactly what we have here. They conceded all these causes of action. But in addition, they brought such absurd causes of action, such as emotional distress causes of action, on behalf of her law firm. Now, we all know that corporations are people under the law for many reasons, but they don't actually have feelings, so they don't suffer emotional distress. Those claims obviously necessarily fail. They also had never alleged any duty under the negligent infliction of emotional distress.
So, Ms. McClatchy, sure. Could I interrupt you if I could?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Because my question relates to the other claims that are covered in the complaint. And I wanted to clarify something. First of all, it's my understanding that four of the claims, injunctive relief, RICO, two others, were acknowledged by appellant in this case that they should be dismissed during the course of the hearing.
Correct.
Okay. Now, you made a statement a moment ago that those four claims were included in the anti-SLAPP order dismissing the complaint. But there were some other claims that were also included. And what I wanted to address is the application of NRS 41650. That statute, as you know, says that a person who engages in a good faith communication in furtherance of a right to petition or the right to free speech in direct connection with an issue of public concern is immune from any civil action for claims based upon the communication. Are any of the six remaining claims beyond defamation based upon any facts other than the communications that are in dispute in this case?
Not as I understand it, because again, what the conspirators, they do have a conspiracy cause of action, but you have to have an associated tort in order to have a conspiracy claim. You have to have an associated wrongful act. And the only wrongful act is the idea that they pointed to, that Mr. Schneider and Mr. Stanton somehow conspired to spread these communications about her behavior in the courtroom. And they've made clear, both in their complaint and throughout the litigation, that the focus of their causes of action, such as...
Well, the reason I ask this question is that the court has had a number of anti-SLAPP cases that we've been dealing with. And a number of those complaints have included other causes of action. But unfortunately, in a number of cases, including this one, you folks mention this statute, but you don't argue it as a basis for the dismissal of the claims. It seems to me that the statute is suggesting, and I'm interested in both parties' comments on this, that if the gravamen of the complaint, if the basis of the complaint rests on communications that are covered by the anti-SLAPP statute,
right,
then the immunity that's provided for in this statute covers all other claims, whether it's conspiracy or extortion or some other tort. What's your view on that?
Our view is that the whole point of the anti-SLAPP statute is to immunize defendants in a case like this. And when you walk through each of their causes of action, their emotional distress causes of action, their business disparagement causes of action, they are all predicated on the idea that, for example, that Ms. Abrams is so thin-skinned that she suffered severe emotional distress from being called seal happy. So they are all predicated on the speech, and that's the reason for the anti-SLAPP statute to exist. It's why you get fees and costs. You're immune from all liability. You're meant to be made whole when you're targeted for engaging in speech. And the focus of their complaint is absolutely the speech. Now, they allege that there's a conspiracy, that the motive for the speech was some sort of conspiracy between Mr. Schneider and Mr. Sanson. But as I pointed out, that's irrelevant to the anti-SLAPP analysis. It's also irrelevant to the defamation analysis. If it's a matter of opinion, you can get together and say, hey, let's tell the world about the fact that Judge Elliott commented on this long history of misbehavior by Ms. Abrams at her law firm.
So then I'd also like to pose this question. There's a fair amount of case law that suggests that commentary on a lawyer's professional performance is appropriate or something that is a matter of public interest. But in this instance, as Mr. Willick suggests, part of this relates to a sanctioned motion in a sealed case. I don't quite understand how that fits within the category of those cases that are dealing with commentary on a lawyer's professional skills or absence thereof.
I believe am I out of time? May I answer?
I'm presiding, so I'm going to give it to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So, with regard to that last question, would you ask it again? Just the end part, I'm sorry.
Sure. The argument about whether the matter fits within Shapiro.
Oh, yes, and I'm sorry. So under the anti-SLAPP analysis and under the Shapiro factors, you look at whether there doesn't have to be a perfect fit. There has to be a close fit between the asserted public interest and the statements at issue. Here, the asserted public interest is the conduct in the courtroom. That specific hearing, it's true, it was part of it was about whether or not a sanctions motion should issue, but the broader context of the article, it starts out talking about Judge Hafen and perhaps judges that overstep the boundaries of proper courtroom behavior, and then it says, okay, well, how about when attorneys overstep their roles? And the article goes on, and in addition to linking to the video, it goes on to discuss what Judge Elliott said about Ms. Abrams. And so the focus of that article had nothing to do with the sanctions motion itself. It had to do with Judge Elliott saying things like, I am the judge, and in a moment I'm going to ask you to leave. Or Judge Abrams saying rudely to the judge things like, are you in a relationship with Mr. Schneider? Or, excuse me, I was talking. And so the focus of this article isn't this private divorce case or the sanctions motion. It is about conduct in the people's courtrooms.
All right, thank you. Do my colleagues have any other questions for Ms.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Willick, you'll have an additional 4 minutes to address in your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll see if I can make just a few points. First, as to Mr. Schrader, Schneider. As you, Justice Stiglitz, pointed out a couple of weeks ago in the Gerber case, when a defendant's communications are not the subject of a defamation claim, there's no right to even make a claim under the anti-SLAPP statute. That second judgment shouldn't exist at all in this case. As to the public interest.
But to that point, if I may, I get the rule you've enunciated, but are there facts asserted in the complaint that form the basis for those other claims for relief beyond the communications?
Yes.
Could you give me an example? Because I read the complaint maybe a little bit differently, so I'd like to be corrected.
That was the whole point of the conspiracy for extortion and why we needed to do the discovery, which I'm going to get to in a second. Because the point was, he made a threat of taking out-of-court action to manipulate an in-court proceeding designed to eliminate a sanctions motion brought against him for egregious overbilling and attempting to sleep with his client. To get rid of that motion, he decided to take action against Ms. Abrams out of court, try to put pressure on her. That by itself, regardless of in this notice pleading state, how neatly it fits into one of the various categories, and it won't be possible to parse it until the discovery that we didn't get to do was completed, would be the conspiracy and extortion count. He could find a request to dismiss at some later time, but that has nothing to do with anti-SLAPP. He could file a 54 motion or whatever. If he felt that the conspiracy couldn't be made out or there wasn't an allegation of an adequate tortious conduct, but that's not this. That doesn't belong here. He doesn't belong in this case at this point. In terms of the public interest, which is related to that, about 3 weeks ago, this court approved rules which specifically permit divorce hearings to be closed, those cases to be sealed, and forbidding the video or other records of those closed hearings from being posted on the internet by third parties. That was the balancing test that this court did in setting up the court rules. And the reason for that is it's not a legitimate matter of public interest. This has nothing to do with conducting the courtrooms or our judicial system. This is a targeted character assassination of a particular individual for an illicit purpose.
Mr. Willis, how do you distinguish Piping Rock Partners?
I don't. I think Piping Rock was the foundation of Shapiro, and Shapiro was the factors that I'm applying. I think that that's exactly the test that we're talking about here. The public has no interest in the private dispute of the Saters or with the attorneys.
So we're talking about the Saters, but we're talking about Ms. Abrams. And how are the comments here, the opinions or whatever, how are they not criticism of her on-the-job performance, which is precisely what Piping Rock covers?
Workplace misconduct below some threshold level of significance is not an issue of public interest, even though it implicates a public policy. That's the Rivera opinion at page 924 from footnote, 127 or whatever. It's not a public interest. It's a private dispute, and a private dispute within a private dispute. It just isn't a matter. And, you know, if you did trace it, what you'd find is that the selective cherry-picking of false statements later corrected even applies to that, because you follow the email string. It ends with Judge Elliott sending Ms. Abrams a note saying, "You are the most ethical attorney I have ever met." That's the email string. So cherry-picking a false headline to give a false fact, and even an opinion based on a false fact, is not permitted. That's the basis of the cases that we were just talking about. In terms of the discovery, there's no ambiguity about Sampson's intention in misstating the facts and stating false facts. He admitted, as recounted in Mr. Schoen's affidavit, that his purpose was to accuse Ms. Abrams of crimes. The question really is what is in the cases that are miscited by our opponents. Pegasus, Wake, they both confirm that the issue of whether a statement is one of fact or opinion is how it would be perceived by the reasonable reader. And a reasonable reader looking at this email string is going to say these are assertions of fact. The fact that there's a link that if you spend enough hours researching it, you can find out that the headline is a lie, does not insulate the lie from being defamatory. Now, you may have to cut that thread a little bit closely, but you can't undo the context. That's what today's case was talking about. You have to look at the gist of it. You have to look at the impact of it. You have to look at what was being communicated. And what was being communicated is that she was found to be unethical, needs to be reported to the bar, and is committing illegal acts, none of which is true.
These are false assertions of fact for an illicit purpose, and that purpose was to remove the sanctions motion. That was the only purpose for this smear campaign to begin. And when you have evidence, and we do, because we have an admission of payment, of the providing of the materials, and of motive, we have a conspiracy for an illicit purpose. We need to be able to do the discovery in order to flesh it out. As to what's a fact and what's an opinion, about 90 days ago, in the Condon case, this court held that accusing judges of acting illegally or unethically are statements of fact, where the accuser said the judges were lawless bullies who altered records, fabricated a lie, acted illegally, and conspired to steal money. The false assertions made against Ms. Abrams are almost identical, that she's a lawless bully who violated the law, obstructed justice, took money for herself rather than for her clients. If those were accusations of fact when made against you, they are accusations of fact when made against her. And they are actionable under our defamation and cannot be cloaked under an anti-SLAPP.
Mr. Willick, if somebody were to post the entire video of this proceeding and then writes an article and says, Justice Stiglitz bullied Mr. Willick, isn't that an opinion? They can watch the video and they can decide. How does that... I'm having trouble with that.
May I answer?
Can you answer?
Yes, yeah. Of course. That wouldn't be, but that's not what happened here. If you take a video of an hour and 20 minute argument, and you tell people, the thing you need to see, headline, is at minute 4, where something that's expressly retracted was said, let's suppose you said something at the beginning of this hearing, and we get to this point in the hearing, and you say, oh, I was wrong, sorry, never mind that, and all that anybody wants to talk about is the false fact that you made an incorrect assertion. That is the gist of the communication, and that's where it fits into defamation. You don't get to parse things word by word in isolation. You have to take a look at the entirety of what is being communicated. And what's being entirely communicated here are false facts and opinions based on knowingly false facts. And there's no public interest in that. This is character assassination for profit. It's extortion, definitionally, and it shouldn't be allowed to happen. It endangers the entire foundation of the judicial system. And we have to stay cognizant of what it is. The speech you should be concerned about is the sanctions motion, which, as soon as Sanson expanded his threats to include the bogus threat of going to judicial discipline, this judge took off calendar and never decided. So he won. He got what he wanted. And that conduct can't be allowed to continue. Because if it is, we endanger what we all do. The conduct we should be concerned about, the speech we should be concerned about, is what happens in the courtrooms. The motions, the oppositions, the resolutions. If you start countenancing people doing things outside the courtroom to alter in-court behavior using illicit means, our entire foundation of judicial progression is, in my opinion, in danger. I thank the court for its time, unless there's other questions.
Any other questions for Mr. Willick?
I just had one question. I know Mr. Houston didn't speak. I was just going to inquire if he joined with Ms. McClatchy's argument.
Just very briefly, two things. Number one, Justice Stiglitz said there's an impression that at the time this was first published, it was a sealed case, and it was not a sealed case. At the time of the first publication, and the whole video was posted online. It was not sealed. It hadn't been sealed after that. So there was a closed hearing that day. We just think people from the outside can't come in. But at the time it was first published, anyone, Joe Blow off the street, Mike, my neighbor, could have walked down and got a copy of this video. So anyone could have obtained that.
Sir, would you come to the podium, identify yourself?
Sure.